Hello, I'm Luc Gauthier. This is number 0599, the Stuff File Program, with your host, Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0599. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, we remember actor Christopher Plummer, who recently passed away, with part of a conversation from 1993. Did he ever hate being reminded about The Sound of Music?
It's a bit of an albatross, but it's a nice albatross to have done because it was such a popular movie and still goes on being a popular movie. You know, it's just sometimes a little bit tedious because you think of all the other things you've done, of quite meritorious stuff. Some people only know you from The Sound of Music, but at least some people are an awful lot of people, and that has helped in many ways. You know, it helped sell the tickets in the theater. I'm very grateful to that movie.
Jennifer Ann Gordon is the author of the gothic horror novel Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent. It follows the story of a man whose wife and young child die in a car accident that he feels responsible for. But in therapy, he hears about a place that might be able to help him.
At one of his group meetings, he hears a story, a rumor, about an island off the coast of Maine. You can go there, and if you want it bad enough, you can be reunited with your loved ones, like their ghost would appear to you. So he travels to Maine. When he's there, he gets sort of involved and obsessed with a female ghost that has been haunting this old boarding house for 60 years and haunting the old man who runs it because he was her murderer.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and this time Book Banter looks back 40 years to the tragic end of the life of rock music legend John Lennon with James Patterson's The Last Days of John Lennon. So have a spoonful of instant karma later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0599, was Luc Gauthier, who is a freelance director and cameraman who is currently working in Brazil. Now, back in the day, when we worked together, he was one of the best cameramen I ever worked with, and also one of the nicest people. Thank you very much, Luc, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Now, let's get right to the stuff. A lawyer has gone viral in Peru after he stripped off and had sex while still on camera during a live-streamed court case.
Please rise. Court is now in session.
I don't think that's what the court had in mind. Hector Cipriano Paredes Robles had been taking part in a virtual hearing involving a feared local gang when he shocked the judge and other viewers with his X-rated display. Robles completely stripped off, then started kissing an equally naked woman who soon straddled him.
All rise.
All rise.
Again, not the intention. The outraged judge, John Chichua Torres, immediately called a halt to the proceedings, ripping Robles for having disrespected the dignity of the court. This lawyer has lacked the honor and dignity of the profession, the judge said.
Better throw this jackass out of my court!
Well, he wasn't quite that forceful. The Bar Association later also stressed that it strongly rejects the obscene acts as it called for a swift investigation into his future in law. Robles, who has yet to publicly address the sex scandal, was replaced in the case and faces a probe, no, not that kind of probe, by the Bar Association.
I object, Your Honor. This trial is a travesty. It's a travesty of a mockery, of a sham, of a mockery, of a travesty, of two mockeries, of a sham.
Are you saying that the evidence didn't stand up in court? A Kentucky animal shelter is raising funds by offering jilted lovers a chance to have cats do their business on the names of their exes. The Lexington Humane Society said donors can pay $10 to get some retribution for their broken hearts by having their exes' names inscribed on the inside of litter boxes to be used by the shelter's cats. Our adoptable kitties have your back and will dump all over your ex, the shelter said in a Facebook post. Cats can be spiteful creatures, and trust us, they are more than happy to take a number two on your former number one. The Dumps for the Dumped promotion ends on February the 12th, but the litter boxes will remain in place until February 15th to ensure they get plenty of use on Valentine's Day. Why do I get the feeling this promotion wasn't started by a guy? And need I say it again? Cats are evil. Little pieces of evil plotting against mankind. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first section here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a woman in Mexico identified only as Leonora R. faces charges of domestic violence after repeatedly stabbing her husband when she found photos of him having sex with a younger, thinner woman on his phone. The husband was eventually able to disarm his wife and clarify that it was her in the photos, which were taken when they were still dating. Police responded to neighbors' calls for help, and they arrived and arrested her. Well, they say that love is blind, but she definitely needs an eye examination. Although, not to put the onus entirely on her, maybe in the heat of passion, her husband isn't the best photographer. However, while he might not have been able to capture his future wife's better side, he certainly did capture her thinner one. Anyway, let's get to our first segment here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? The entertainment world has lost another giant, the city of Montreal has lost a homegrown talent, and Canada has lost one of its greatest exports. Christopher Plummer, the oldest actor ever to win an Oscar, died on February 5th at his home in Connecticut at the age of 91. I had the pleasure and honor of talking to the classically trained actor, who was also the great-grandson of John Abbott, Canada's third prime minister. We spoke back in June of 1993. Here is a portion of that conversation now.
It's a pleasure to talk to you this evening.
Pleasure to talk to anyone talking from my town.
How many years has it been since you've been in your hometown?
No, I usually come up every year because I still have family, and I still have many, many old friends who live there. And I drive up from Connecticut, and it's only a five-hour drive right from my door to the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, and I zoom up, and I pay a visit to everybody. So I come up hopefully twice a year.
Well, that's an interesting question. Where do you call home these days?
Connecticut.
Connecticut?
Yeah. I've been living in the States since the mid-70s when I came back from Europe, mm-hmm. because I've made that my home for a long time because of work reasons.
Well, we should mention right now we're talking to you from Toronto, and you're getting ready to do a one-man show, A Word or Two Before You Go, and it's as part of the Stratford Festival this summer.
Well, it's not really part of the Stratford Festival.
Or a benefit, I should say.
It's a benefit for them, and it's being done on the festival stage because they asked me last year if I would go up and play again, and I said I couldn't this year, but instead I would love to give them this one-man show to raise money for the theater, and they all very nicely said they'd love it. So here I am, and it's a show that I think is very suitable for Stratford. It's very entertaining, and it's filled with great and less great literature, and it's a kind of personal story of my own in which I play different characters along the way, and I use some of my favorite poems and I talk some of my favorite prose, and it's all linked by my own sort of my own story of growing up.
You actually wrote and arranged this yourself, did you not?
Oh yes, I've done it three times before, and it seems to work like a treat, and I change it all the time because of course one gets new ideas. And wherever we do it, I put some local kind of feeling to it, like a story of the place. And I'll certainly have quite a few stories about Stratford stage. And I take it right through youth to old age and back again, and all the poems that I've and prose that I've loved all my life, that I grew up with. So I was amazed when I finally was asked to do it many years ago, why someone else hadn't done it before. It turned out to be a very personal evening, and the audiences like that because I think they get to know me.
What was the idea that initially brought this to the stage the first time?
Well, somebody in my local town when I was living in Connecticut in the late 70s asked me to do something for the town. They said, you haven't done a damn thing for us yet. You've been living here for 5 years. Why don't you do something like give a lecture at the library and raise some money for some charity? And I said, well, a lecture sounds awful dull to me, so let me think about it. And I thought, well, why not? Why not just do some wonderful stuff that I love to do, or read poetry or learn the poetry in prose, and then write a little story to go along with it. It became bigger and bigger and bigger until it became a show.
Well, you've done so much in your career. You've done television, you've done radio, films, stage. Is there a preference that you have, or you just love doing it all?
Variety is the spice of life, that famous old saying, and it's true. I would hate to just do one thing out of those four, because each feeds the other. The one I miss most, is, funnily enough, is radio, because that's a medium that I grew up in. I grew up in Montreal playing on the both the French and the English network, and then I went to Toronto and played on the stage series with Andrew Allen, when radio in Canada was absolutely superb. It was their artistic identity back in the late 40s, and I miss that whole era, and I love them. So I've always loved words, and radio seemed to be the perfect medium for words, because you can imagine what the people saying them look like. I always thought it was such a powerful medium, and I miss the drama that we used to listen to all the time on the air. It's a shame it's sort of gone. Maybe one day it'll come back. I don't know.
Over your career, you've been one of those actors, when people think of classically trained actors, your name comes to mind, yet you have a very commercial aspect to your career, and you cross back and forth several times. There is no, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for, no title one can, or area one can pigeonhole you in.
Do
you find that that's a problem sometimes, that when somebody says, oh, classically trained or Shakespearean trained actor, that one automatically thinks somewhat stuffy?
No, well, they know me by now. They know that that's not true.
But, I mean, do you find that that's a problem generally with the whole... Like, lately, Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson have just put out this new movie, Much Ado About Nothing.
I saw it the other night.
And it has brought Shakespeare to a whole new audience. And initially, when people were talking about putting this film on, there was a groan for some people, but people are really enjoying it. Do you find that what they're doing, to a certain degree, is bringing Shakespeare to everyone and making it more viable to the general population, for which it was originally written for in the first place?
Yes, exactly. And actually, what is doing them a favor is the fact that it's beautifully done. I've even preferred it to his Henry V. It is an absolutely beautifully done movie. It's young, it's attractive, it's sexy, it's everything that Shakespeare is and wrote about. It's only the dyed-in-the-wool people who always are afraid that Shakespeare is scholastic and heavy, and that's not true. And one of from going to the movie to the theater again, one of the reasons I like to do this evening of mine is to re-enthuse people, particularly young people, into showing them how entertaining great words are, and the fact that language, great language, is slowly and slowly becoming extinct with the terrible sort of introduction of computerized education and computer everything. We forget the great language that is our heritage and the great enrichment to one's life that it does bring. And that's one of the purposes of this evening of mine, is to remind them what not only is it enriching, but it's a hell of a lot of fun.
Getting back a little bit to some of the more commercial work you have done, you worked with another great Montrealer a couple of years ago in a Star Trek movie.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
What was it like doing that? First of all, beyond the makeup, you had to go through a lot of makeup, I'm sure.
Yes.
But what was it like doing a Star Trek role?
Oh, well, I've always been a fan. You know, I'm a sort of slight Trekkie myself over the years. I've always watched that show with great love, the early ones in the 60s, and then right through. I've always been a loyal fan of Star Trek. It was fun to get asked to do it. The director, whom I like very much, who wrote, who I think did all the best Star Treks. I mean, he wrote the Whale one, which was number 4, and he directed the second one.
Irv Bennett?
Khan. No, Nicholas, his last name it just disappears from me at the moment. Nicholas, and he wrote and directed... I'm sure you can get it for me.
Yeah.
He brought such entertainment. I thought that Star Trek VI was the best of the lot, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It was great fun to do, and it was great fun to introduce myself back to Bill again. We had good fun talking. I think our conversation had not stopped from when we left 36 years before. We just picked up where we left off.
When I told people I was going to be talking to Christopher Plummer today, walking through the building here at the station, the first thing that came to everyone's lips, they started singing Edelweiss. Has that song followed you through your career because of The Sound of Music?
Yes, of course it has. It's a bit of an albatross, but it's a nice albatross to have done because it was such a popular movie and still goes on being a popular movie. And, you know, it's just sometimes a little bit tedious because you think of all the other things you've done, of quite meritorious stuff. Some people only know you from The Sound of Music, but at least some people are an awful lot of people, and that has helped in many ways. You know, it helps sell the tickets in the theater. I'm very grateful to that movie.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that when they count box office grosses, there are a lot of other films, a lot of them by Steven Spielberg, that have racked up lots of money. But I think Sound of Music is still up there as far as tickets sold is concerned. And if you attribute 1993 dollars to the box office back then, it would probably still be in the top three, if not number one.
Well, it could be. I suppose Gone with the Wind, you see, is still up there if you count all the tickets over the years. I suppose it is one of the top grossing films of all time. I don't know how many now or what number it is down the list. I don't know. But that doesn't interest me so much. The fact that it does get a whole new audience every year because the kids go. And that's why it lasts.
And it holds up well.
It might be a little bit yellow around the edges, but it's kind of timeless, yeah.
Another thing that people know you for of late is the television series Counter-Strike, which is seen on CTV. How did you get involved with a television series like that?
Well, it was very nice because normally I'd never do a television series, but I couldn't resist the deal. It was only 40 days a year work. I came to Toronto like for 2 weeks and Paris for 2 weeks out of the year. So I couldn't say no to that, and I got very handsomely paid for it. Thank you very much. And so I said, yeah. It didn't interfere with anything else I wanted to do. I could do movies, plays, whatever. And did. I'm sorry it's over because it was a lovely nest egg.
Is it over?
Yeah, it's finished. Canada is seeing the last year. Mm-hmm. They're a year behind USA and Paris and France. But it has been canceled, yeah.
Would you ever think of doing another television series?
Well, only if it really was unusually, you know, exciting and good, because it takes, normally the most television series take your whole life out of you. You know, your life is not your own any longer. It's devoted to going to the studio every day, and it's a killer. I was very lucky with Counter-Strike because it was such a short duration of time.
There is so much you've done in your career. Is there anything that you haven't done that you're still hoping to do?
God, of course. I mean, I could be very funny, but I can't afford to be at this moment. But yeah, there are tons of parts I want to play. I also want to direct. I'm writing a book, which I've just begun. And I'm writing adaptations and concert versions of classics to music, which we've performed and recorded already. So I've got another world that I'm looking at, which is nice. I don't want to just do one thing.
Has there been any popular movie or television series or something out there that you've seen that you said, gee, I wish I could have done that?
No, I don't. I'm not a person who goes around crying over either spilt milk or dreaming of things I could have done. There are lots of things I want to do, and I will do them. And I've been very happy with my life. I think I've been very lucky. I've certainly enjoyed a variety of success. I think I count myself fortunate, my friend.
Well, you're obviously a very talented man, and I understand in a lot of cases the acorn doesn't fall too far from the tree. Your daughter, Amanda, has got a very good career going for herself, too. You must be very proud.
Yes, I am indeed. And she hasn't called me lately, so I know she's doing well.
Was there any hesitation as a parent in this business to see your own child go into the business?
Well, we were separated, her mother and I, and so I didn't know Amanda until I came back from Europe. I lived in Europe for 20 years. She was already grown by then, to 18-year-old, and she wasn't interested in the theater at all, and suddenly she fell into it, I suppose because of us, her parents, and she started winning all the prizes. And I thought, oh, my God, what monster have we all created? She won the Tony very young for her extraordinary performance in Agnes of God on Broadway, which catapulted her to success. It also made it quite tough for her because she she had been given such high praise too young, I thought, you know, so you always have to live that down.
Did she have to concern herself with the plumber name? Did that open doors or close doors for her?
Well, I think it opened a few, possibly. But she was her own boss and her own personality. We certainly weren't responsible for her desires or her talent, and she was determined, and she got her role because she was unique and different. And I must say, when I saw her in that play, she terrified me. I didn't have any recognition of her as being my daughter or a family member. She was so good in it. She was so foreign to me. I was terribly impressed with her.
Was there more anticipation before you saw her on the stage, more nervousness because she was your child than even when you went on stage yourself?
Oh, of course. Oh, God, yes. You know you can take care of yourself. Yeah. I've been through too many disasters to know that. Yeah, I was terrified until she walked on, and then I was totally relaxed. Then she terrified me in a different way.
Did she ask for any advice from Dad before she got into the business?
Yeah, I think she would have. We don't, you know, we didn't see each other a lot because of our vast separation. And I didn't want to push suddenly Dad coming into the life, you know, which is rather boring. And suddenly it would look like Dad was holding onto the coattails of her success. So I had to kind of be discreetly away from her for a while, and I stayed away on purpose. I have a feeling she would think I was hopelessly old-fashioned. I wanted to go on doing what she does without giving her too much advice. I don't think she needs it from me.
Okay, well, getting back to Dad for a few moments, you've made over 50 motion pictures. You just, I understand, completed a movie with the Oscar-winning director Mike Nichols.
Yeah, I haven't quite finished it. I have to go back and do one more week out in L.A.
The movie's called Wolf, I understand?
Wolf, yes. It's a sort of dark, very charming comedy, sort of a wild kind of comedy. It's got terrific cast, Jack Nicholson, Michelle Pfeiffer, Kate Nelligan, Prunella Scales, Eileen Atkins, myself. It was a wonderful group of people, and Mike, of course, is, I've worked with before. As an, he's a friend and is a brilliant director, so I hope to God this will be a big success.
And when will that be released?
Heaven knows, it's a huge movie. I never know, you know, it's either Christmas or next spring, one or the other.
Well, that's great. Do you prefer a genre? We've already discussed whether you like the classics as opposed to more commercial work. Do you have a preference between drama, comedy?
No, there's no preference. I mean, they both all help each other, you know. When you do a comedy, you put some drama into it to break up the monotony. When you do drama, you try and be as funny as you can. I love all commercial and classic, contemporary and classics. You must do them all, otherwise you get terribly stereotyped.
Well, you've had a very long career that has seen a lot of great work. Not that I want to jinx you in any way, shape, or form, but how would you like to be remembered?
Oh, no, I don't answer that question. I've heard that question so often, Peter. I have refused to answer that question.
Okay.
I mean, one could be funny and say, as a rake. That's what I want. as a terrible rake. that would make me happy.
Christopher Plummer will be known for being much more than a rake. The Oscar, Tony, and Emmy winner, who is also a Companion of the Order of Canada, has left us at the age of 91. He will be missed. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship, or a warning.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent. Plus, Stuart Noman is along with another edition of Book Banter. We also have an Idiot of the Day and much more in Stuff File News here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere for all of your devices. You can hear it on Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. Plus, a host of radio stations. And thanks to all for joining in on the show. Well, A Florida man is recovering from a cottonmouth snake bite to his lip after he allegedly tried to kiss the serpent on the mouth. Hillsborough County Sheriff's deputies said 18-year-old Austin Hatfield captured the 4-foot cottonmouth, also known as a water moccasin, while swimming last week and kept it in a pillowcase at his girlfriend's house where he was bitten on the lip. Now, friends told investigators Hatfield was trying to kiss the snake when it struck him. Hatfield was initially hospitalized in critical condition, but his status was upgraded to good condition, and officials say he is expected to make a full recovery. Investigators said Hatfield did not possess the proper permits required by the state to keep and catch cottonmouth snakes. Really? That's the takeaway by the authorities? Okay. You know, here's a guy who didn't even bother to read the first chapter in his Bible. You don't bring a serpent over to your girlfriend's house and try to kiss it. Also, no bobbing for apples. 19-year-old Trey Brown allegedly pulled a scam at the Gwinnett County, Georgia Kroger store where he worked. Said Gwinnett County Police Corporal Colin Flynn, this employee was essentially creating fake items, taking those items and returning them to a credit card he had, and just making up prices for those items. The first return was for around $10, but over the next 2 weeks, Brown got more brazen. When an employee tasked with flagging fraudulent transactions returned from a 2-week vacation and noticed the fraud, by then totaling over $980,000, police were called in. As he continued to get away with it, the prices continued to go up until he made a return for over $87,000. Brown allegedly used the money to buy clothes, guns, food, and 2 vehicles, one of which he quickly crashed. He was charged with 1 count of felony theft. Well, I guess he was taught to either go big or go home. Nobody mentioned the go-to-jail part. You know, it kind of makes you wonder how long he might have been able to get away with it if he were more frugal. Then again, it makes you wonder how many people are getting away with similar types of crimes because they are frugal. And we have one more story in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. There are always stories of people driving after having a couple too many. For those who insist upon doing it, the rule is to make yourself as inconspicuous as possible. Stay under the speed limit, avoid swerving at all costs. Oh, and make sure your vehicle has a windshield. Ignoring this last rule is what got one Nova Scotian man arrested. The axe didn't help either. RCMP were called to a section of highway for a motor vehicle complaint. Responding officers found a parked car straddling the white line. The car was missing its front windshield. There was a hole in the back window, glass on the highway, and an axe in the back seat. At first, police said it appeared the car was empty, but then a man leaned forward in the driver's seat. He was later identified as Trent William Lewis. Lewis asked police why they had pulled him over. It was then that the officer noticed Lewis had his pants pulled down to his knees. The officer ordered Lewis out of the car and told him to pull up his pants. It was then that Lewis took off running. He did not get very far before being tackled by the cops. At Lewis's trial, a woman testified that she drove Lewis and another man from Liverpool toward Bridgewater. Then Lewis started freaking out. She said Lewis kicked out the windshield, at which point she and the other man fled. Lewis himself remembers little of the event leading up to his arrest, other than that they involved a quart of rum, cocaine, and a 4-day house party. You know, at this point in time in the world we live in, with all that is going on right now, the worst part of this story for me is the term 4-day house party. Yeah. That seems like the most reckless part of this story when you think about it. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Jennifer Ann Gordon is a gothic horror novelist. Her latest novel is a ghost story with a twist. It's called Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent. Jennifer joins us via Skype from New Hampshire. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you?
Jess Tickety-Boo, thanks very much for being on the program with us. As I said, this is a story with a twist, so I'll kind of let you explain the plot here.
Okay. I know sometimes it's difficult to explain the plot without explaining the twists, but I'll go for it. Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent is a story about a man named Adam who's recently lost his young son and his wife in a car accident, and he feels responsible for that. Adam has a kind of a rough life. He's had childhood trauma, so he doesn't really have like the emotional toolbox to deal with grief. So he descends into alcoholism and mental illness. And at one of his group meetings, he hears a story, a rumor about an island off the coast of Maine that if you can go there and if you want it bad enough, you can be reunited with your loved ones, like their ghost would appear to you. So he travels to Maine to be reunited with the ghost of his very young son. His son was 4 when he passed away. And when he's there, he gets sort of involved and obsessed with a female ghost that has been haunting this old boarding house for 60 years and haunting the old man who runs it because he was her murderer. So the ghost, the murderer, and young Adam sort of develop this very strange, psychologically twisted menage a grief relationship as Adam, again, he's very much descending into madness and you don't quite know what's real and what's not. So,
well, without asking about descending into madness from your perspective, where does a story like this come from out of your mind?
You know, honestly, it was burst out of my mind about 20 years ago when I tried to write it as a 3-person play and it didn't work. But I was actually inspired by, I had a friend who was a writer and we were just like bouncing ideas back and forth from each other. And he said the words, "Oh, my uncle is a cop and one of the people on the police force murdered his fiance right before they got married and the entire police force covered it up." And that thought kind of just like stuck in my head. And that was like the little, you know, birthing point for this story. Anthony, the murderer in my book, is not a police officer. I didn't take that case or anything, but I did take the idea of what if you killed somebody and their ghost haunted you forever? Like, you kill somebody, you get away with it. Your whole life is quote unquote fine. But what if it's not? Like, what does that feel like to live with that kind of guilt? Do you have guilt? You know, he's kind of a villain, so he sometimes feels guilty, but not a lot, not enough.
Now, the story takes place in Maine.
Yes.
Stephen King is also from Maine, by the way.
Yes, you know, it's horror country.
And I was about to say, it's not just him alone. There seems to be a lot of stories that take place in Maine that are horror related. What is it about Maine?
You know, for me, I find the Maine coastline, especially, to be almost otherworldly. It's very rocky. The water is very cold. It's very tumultuous. So I've always found coastlines and the ocean to be very intriguing. Everything from like shipwrecks and drownings and things like that. But then if you get in the interior part of Maine, away from the coast, it is just so much nothing. It's mountains, it's deep, deep, almost impenetrable woods, and these tiny little towns that really feel like they don't belong in this century at all. And people who have lived there their whole lives and they've never even been to Boston, which is like 2 hours away. So there's just something old and beautiful and strange about Maine. I love it.
And when it comes to ghosts, with the possible exception of Casper, none of them ever seem to be happy. And by the way, while I bring up Casper, I think Casper is just an overjoyed child, and I get the feeling that he was probably beaten to death by other kids who just thought he was too optimistic.
I have my mixed feelings about Casper. I have a lot of, I had childhood theories about who Casper was the ghost of, you know, just like Casper was just like part of this evolution of a child who eventually turned into the that little devil character because they were all from the same. I thought Casper was the ghost of Richie Rich. That's what I remember thinking.
So did I. I thought that too.
Because they were from the same company and they were drawn the same way. So my theory as a kid was somebody murdered Richie Rich for his money. And then he turned into Casper. And then Casper, over the years, became very evil and he turned into Hot Stuff the Little Devil.
Hmm. So since we are definitely delving into the mind of Jennifer Ann Gordon, you've mentioned ghosts as a child, although I brought it up, but you ran with it. So are ghosts something that's always been interesting to you?
Yes. Yes, definitely. There was a cemetery really close to my house when I was little, and all of the neighborhood kids would play there because we didn't have a park, and it was kind of in between all of our houses. So, like, we just were like these little weird gothic troop of kids playing in a cemetery.
Wow. Now, you mentioned that this is something you started. This book, Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent, is something you wanted to start 20 years ago, and it didn't work out then, and now it's your novel, your debut novel. What is it in the perseverance that you just couldn't let it go, which is an admirable trait, by the way, because sometimes people will try something and it doesn't work out and they put it aside and never get back to it. But you obviously kept with it.
Yeah, I went back to it a few more times. I tried it as a play, very lightly tried it as a play, and it didn't work. Then I thought that it would make a great graphic novel. So I started storyboarding it out as a graphic novel. And this was about 10 or 11 years ago now, but I couldn't find the right artist, and it would bankrupt me if I did it because I'd have to pay the artist so much money. And so the story just kept like tickling the back of my head. And honestly, a lot of times when I couldn't sleep at night, I would just tell myself this story in my head like it was a movie, and I would fall asleep, and the next night I would kind of like start where I had left off. And I just kind of fell in love with this character, Adam, and I wanted to write him so badly that I thought, well, maybe I'll just try it and maybe it'll be a short story. And I started writing it, and the whole book just sort of poured out of me. It became much more than I thought it was going to be. I'm very proud of it. It started to win awards, which was shocking and fun, and It's been a good year for that book.
Well, again, with the perseverance, we have life experiences. We go through things through our lives. We get better, hopefully, at what we do as we gain experience. Do you think this is a much better book, a far better book than it could have been 20 years ago?
Yes, 150%. Because there's a lot of me in this book. There's a lot of me in the character of Adam. There's a lot of me in the character that's the ghost. Because in the last 20 years, you know, before the idea first started and now where I'm very happy, I was involved in a abusive relationship. So that gave me more depth for my character, who's the ghost, what it felt like to be, you know, murdered by the person that you were in love with.
When it comes to stories like this, and again, obviously it's written from a woman's perspective.
No, it's not actually.
It's not. Okay.
No, I write multiple points of view. So it's mostly from Adam's perspective, but I also write from the perspective of the murderer. And I do write from the perspective of the ghost. But her parts are more written in like a free verse poetry. She experiences the world differently than we do. She experiences time differently than we do. because she's not alive. So to her, you know, she refers to it as like her long, endless day that started 60 years ago. And she's, you know, she doesn't sleep. She doesn't do anything. She just haunts this man.
Wow. She really needs to hang out with Casper.
Yeah. Well, there is a creepy little kid ghost in the book.
Okay. Great. When you start to write and you're fleshing out these characters, you obviously have to, in some way, shape, or form, kind of decide how likable or how unlikable these characters are. In other words, pardon the pun when talking with a ghost, but how do you flesh out these characters' personas without making them too nice or too evil?
I don't think I've ever had the problem of making a character too nice. So I just, we'll take that one right off the table. I like to write about beautifully broken people and beautifully broken characters. So I'm a total pantser, which means I fly by the seat of my pants. I know who the characters are when I start it, but then I almost hear their voice in my head and I get to know them more. So I start to develop their backstory as I'm writing them. They're in kind of their key memories of their life that shaped their personality. Those things come out during the writing process. And I don't think anybody's pure evil or pure good. And my favorite thing to do is to take a character who does seem pure evil, like my character Anthony, who's the murderer, and, you know, sort of give you little flashes to his childhood that make you understand why he is the way he is. And flashes that almost make you like him.
Well, it's a fascinating concept indeed. The book is called Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent. Jennifer, thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun. And I know your show, you've interviewed all sorts of famous people. So I think Tippi Hedren was one.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. So I just feel like I'm basking in greatness with a Hitchcock girl.
Jennifer Ann Gordon, author of Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0599, and you'll find links to Jennifer's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You'll also find a link to the podcast she co-hosts with two other writers called Vox Vomitus, which features discussions with other authors. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nallman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And here he is, a person who is not bigger than Jesus. As a matter of fact, Jesus was a little taller. Stuart Nallman. Hi, Stu.
Hello, Peter. How you doing?
Oh, gosh. I knew you were going to do this. Oh, 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 dear Lord.
Well,
my ears, my ears.
Mark.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, yeah, yeah. You got that right. Well, on this edition of Book Banter,
Forget the title of the show?
What's that?
Did you almost forget the title of the show? There was that pause.
No, that's the dramatic pause.
Oh, okay, okay, okay.
Because we have maybe a little drama here, but it deals with, yes, because of the remark that you said earlier and my rather puddlian accent, or my attempt at it, deals with John Lennon, the former Beatle, because hard to believe, it's been a little over 40 years since that event on December 8th, 1980, when John Lennon was shot to death in front of the Dakota, the palatial New York City apartment building where he, Yoko Ono, and their son Sean lived, by a deranged, obsessed fan named Mark David Chapman. And John's violent and timely end came at a time when he just started a career comeback after a five-year self-imposed exile, in which his new album Double Fantasy and its first single Just Like Starting Over were rapidly climbing the charts, and there was even talk of a world tour for 1981. But what were the events in both Lennon's and Chapman's respective lives that eventually crossed paths on that tragic night in December of 1980? Well, mega best-selling author James Patterson, best known for his popular Alex Cross murder mysteries, delves into the facts of this tragic event in rock music history with his second non-crime, non-fiction book, The Last Days of John Lennon. Now, I like the book, and it's very well written. And you see, basically, he basically gives the reader a great deal. Let him give Patterson a lot of credit for this. And I'll tell you why. Because he tells his story without having to economize on many of the vital facts that would have made the book end up like a cheap paperback crime novel. And with the nearly 100 pages of notes at the end of the book, it's a vivid testimony to the diligent research Patterson committed in order to make the text factually credible. So thanks to that, he brings to light several instances in Lennon's life that have been rarely recounted. And one of my favorites that he does write in the book is... It happened on a Saturday night in the spring of 1976 when actually Paul McCartney visited John at the Dakota and decided to watch that night's broadcast of Saturday Night Live, in which executive producer Lorne Michaels appeared on camera at the beginning of the broadcast and proposed a Beatles reunion on the show for a flat fee of $3,000. Now, both of them were tempted to just pick themselves up and go directly to the NBC studios at 30 Rock and make a surprise appearance, but he decided against it at the last minute. And according to an interview that McCartney gave last year to Patterson, he said, and I quote, "We decided it was too much like work and that it would be more fun to have the night off."
Hmm.
Interesting. And there's also the main events in John Lennon's life that are covered in the book, like his initial meeting with Paul McCartney in 1957, the trial by fire in Hamburg and Liverpool. And yes, we were more popular than Jesus remark, the lost weekend period. And to give the book that much needed sense of balance, Patterson interjects the Lennon narrative with the three-day period of December 6th to 8th, 1980, in which he follows Chapman's quest for notoriety by meandering around the streets of New York until he familiarizes himself with Lennon's world in New York, especially the Dakota luxury apartment building, in order to make him more comfortable as he readies himself for his deed of death. And it almost reads like one of Patterson's Alex Cross thrillers, which makes me wish that Detective Cross would be in hot pursuit of Chapman and stop him just in time before he does any harm. Now, although many people are aware of this day of infamy and its violent outcome, James Patterson has proved in the last days of John Lennon, of Lennon's iconic status in the world of rock music as its most vocal and creative rebel, and the pain many Beatles fans still feel, you know, more than 40 years after the fact. Now, James Patterson has shown he can write highly readable nonfiction books that don't necessarily have to deal with crimes and mysteries. And that has made one point that's quite starkly clear with this book, that we still sorely miss John Lennon.
I hearken back to the days when the Dakota building was only known for being the home of Lauren Bacall.
Yeah. And now it has a much bigger notoriety.
Yeah.
Something that we wish that we didn't get.
Exactly.
And I visited there, I think, back in 2004. And I just stood there for like maybe 5-10 minutes and just stared at the entrance at the building. you can't, it just has that magnetic, you know, pull when you go there.
You just stood there and stared at the building?
Well, yes. Well, not like, but I moved around a little bit. I didn't just stand there, you know.
How long before security came out?
Well, like I said, that's when I made my, way to Central Park.
Oh, okay. Okay. So the book is?
The Last Days of John Lennon by James Patterson. It's published by Little Brown, and it's $38.
And what other books do you recommend in this genre, sir?
Well, it deals with John Lennon. I'm not going to say his two books that he wrote, In His Own Right and A Spaniard in the Works, but the two biographies that are must-reads if you're a Beatles fan and you want to know more about John Lennon. One is by Ray Coleman, which was a two-volume work, and the other is John Lennon, The Life by Philip Norman, who's done some other great rock biographies too.
Okay, excellent. So again, this week's book is
The Last Days of John Lennon by James Patterson, and it's published by Little Brown, and it's $38.
And I'm assuming we won't find you in Strawberry Fields, so where will we find you?
Well, somewhere where nothing is real, and that's, well, actually is real. And that's the pages of the Montreal Times every week, in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
And just remember, yeah. I am not the walrus.
Well, the walrus is a little taller.
Yes, he was. And they admitted in black in Glass Onion that the walrus was Paul.
There you
so
go.
I deny all allegations.
Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you and, of course, an idiot of the day. Here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, 30-year-old Thomas Dodd admits he was drunk when he filled out the paperwork to legally change his name. The nightclub manager from Tamworth, Staffordshire, England, was watching a Christmas Eve concert by singer Celine Dion at home on the telly since he couldn't go out due to COVID, and the drink emboldened his decision. But he forgot about it until the paperwork arrived confirming his name change to Celine Dion. At first, I didn't think it was me that had done it, but in a way, that just sums up 2020, Dodd, or I should say, Dion said. I should not have been left alone with a bottle of champagne. On the other hand, my name is still Celine Dion, and I don't plan on changing it back. It keeps people smiling and laughing, and we could all do with that. He plans to study to become a paramedic. Well, at least that will be a job where he'll meet all sorts of people who did much more ridiculous things than that after drinking. Anyway, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
34-year-old Edner Flores entered a PNC Bank branch in Chicago's Humboldt Park neighborhood on January 27th. By the way, Humboldt Park is on Chicago's west side, not the south side where Bad Bad Leroy Brown is from. Anyway, Flores allegedly tried to rob the bank by handing a teller a note stating that he wanted $10,000 with no dye packs and that he was armed. And by the way, he spelled dye, D-I-E. The teller activated a silent alarm and had Flores fill out a blue withdrawal slip, which he did, then asked for his ATM card. The helpful Flores instead produced a temporary Illinois state ID card, which included his photo, name, address, and date of birth. When police arrived, Flores was still at the teller's window, filling out forms. They arrested him and found a knife in his jacket. Now, why? Oh, why? If you're going to rob a bank, would you hang around long enough to fill out withdrawal slips and hand the teller all your vital information, giving more than enough time for the cops to show up? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0599. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0599. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Let me leave you with these words of wisdom. Never, ever juggle ice picks while standing on your waterbed.